And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. About 4 or 5 months ago, in June of 2020, MCAN was honored to take on a new executive director. And we have the good fortune to chat with her today. Sarah Dooling has come to us, was originally from Boston, spent some time in Austin, Texas, working in various environmental nonprofits, Living City Austin, all kinds of good stuff. Taught for a while at the University of Texas, comes to us with impeccable credentials in organizing, nonprofit operating, all kinds of good things. We're thrilled to have her with us today just to say hello. So, Sarah Dooling, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ted. That was a very lovely introduction. I'm just so happy to be here. I'm happy to be back in my home landscape, and I'm happy to be part of the MCAN community with our advocates and our partners really working to get the Commonwealth to zero emissions by 2040.
Remember that, folks. That's an important number. And you'll notice Sarah is good to her word. She does not have a Texas accent, right? She did not pick one up during your time down in Austin, right?
No.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. What have things you've had? I know. I'll let you tell the interesting stories, but you've been around a lot of places, seen a lot of stuff, right?
I have, yes, I've been around the United States quite a bit doing many different things, but I originally started out going to high school in Newton, Mass, went to Newton North. I left and I got a degree in wildlife ecology from the University of Maine, and then I traveled around the country for about 10 years, really focusing on how humans were harming endangered species and their habitats. But I was schooled I was trained in the old school of ecology that said people are the problem, always the problem, and nature is to be protected and preserved. And that kind of left me without a lot of training or tools to have productive conversations with, for example, ranchers that were shooting state enlisted birds in Montana. I had no way of interacting with this person, so I decided I need to get myself retrained. So I went back to school and got a master's in social work in the advocacy track, in the community engagement track. And I spent a lot of time in what is called Down East Maine, doing all kinds of work, especially though working with adolescents that were having babies. And that's when I really realized that, you know, birds and people are vulnerable in different ways, but the outcome can be the same. And so these young parents were trying to get to parenting classes that were mandated by the state, but the bus route didn't go frequently enough for them. And so their babies were being taken away because they couldn't fulfill the state mandate to attend a parenting class. So it really impressed upon me that there are all these interacting systems that if we're thinking about creating a livable, equitable future, we have to have a comprehensive, holistic approach to our solutions and our strategies. That point in time, as a social worker, the environment did not really count. It wasn't considered a legitimate source of influence on people's well-being.
It's an interesting point. You just to make is that at that point, environmental issues, which now hadn't quite the penny hadn't dropped, so to speak, that those were interactive with the kind of social welfare of people and communities, right? Interesting
right.
point. I mean, okay.
Right. So this was back in the late. When was this? This was back in the late 1990s, early 2000s. And now there's a whole field of what's called green social work. But back then, that was not the case. And so once again, I felt not fully trained or equipped to really take on the work of, you know, coalescing a group of people to come up with these comprehensive holistic strategies for vulnerable populations, whether that was piping plovers or adolescent parents. So I was fortunate enough to end up going to the University of Washington and being supported by the National Science Foundation, who had an agenda. They had a program that paid people to go study how to creatively bring multiple systems together in order to propose policies and programs that cut across the siloed ways in which we organize knowledge, funding, government, institutions.
From my side of the technical aisle, you'd call that a systems engineer.
Right.
You're basically recognizing that everything's got to dance and play together, right? There's lots of things going on.
Right.
Interesting.
Yes. So it was there at the University of Washington where I really started to work on what a lot of people now refer to as green gentrification. I had a different name for it back then when I was writing about it early on in the mid-2000s. But really thinking about how the unintended consequences of setting up these urban nature preserves, if these preserves are set up by kicking out homeless people and sort of letting them go on their way without offering any kind of services or connecting them to services, it's a perpetuation of this divide between the social parts of urban living in our society and the natural systems, nature, protection strategies. Right. And they need to come together, because if they don't, we're just going to be perpetuating these divides that the pandemic has so radically revealed to us today.
Interesting. So. How did you get to Austin from state of Washington, right?
I know. I miss Seattle so much. So I was hired by the University of Texas at Austin to come and teach in the School of Architecture, but also have an appointment in the Geological Sciences, and to bring together designers and scientists and planners and engineers and economists and ecologists around this idea of urban ecology, which again is a multi-systems way of thinking about how cities can be equitable and livable for critters and people.
Right, an organic, holistic approach to, you know, an entity that is the city that has lots of aspects that need to interact.
Right. Yes, and I had so much fun. I had a lot of fun at UT Austin. The students were graduate students from all over campus, and they're still very near and dear to my heart. And some of them are just doing phenomenal work around the country, in housing and workforce development and energy equity. It's really fabulous. I left UT to actually move more into an activist space. And to set up a nonprofit that is still going, although they're sort of quiet at the moment, Living City ATX, livingcityatx.org is that website. And we brought together a coalition. I was a co-founder. We brought together a big coalition of regulators, city regulators, green infrastructure engineers, designers, architects, and affordable housing advocates. And we were heavily involved in revising the land use development code a few years ago. And we actually created one of the very few spaces in that city to bring these different constituent groups together for real-time conversations that were hard to have. How can we improve environments in historically underinvested neighborhoods without unintentionally creating economic hardship through an increase, right?
And I mean, it seems as if everything you've described is not only that you're slightly ahead of the curve all the time in each of these instances, right? But the things that you've been working on are very much in line with the kinds of issues that MCAN faces, right? I mean, we're talking about cities and towns in Massachusetts that have all, they're the same thing, right? Do you see much, what sort of continuity do you see from what you've been doing into the challenges that MCAN has, which, of course, for anyone who's not an MCAN or listening to this podcast, MCAN works with cities and towns across the state of Massachusetts to get clean energy by 2040, right? And basically, but there's lots of implications of that. A lot of ways, as my father would say, nine ways to skin a cat, right? There's lots of ways to get there. So tell me, you know, what continuity do you see from where you were to where you are?
The main continuity between Austin advocates and institutions and advocates I have encountered here in Massachusetts is the passion, is the belief that we actually can figure out, for example, how to increase access to clean energy for low-income households, a commitment, and this is something that MCAN is working on right now with a lot of our partner organizations, how to retrofit affordable housing typologies in ways that are economically affordable to developers, but also ensure that tenants don't end up paying an initially higher rent cost because of these capital investments required. Absolutely. So what the continuity is really that people are beginning to see how these systems come together, the system around equity, the right to stay, but also the systems that we have to use, both technological systems and regulatory systems, to really get our emissions down. And increasingly, the healthcare system, not only in terms of maintaining safety from COVID, but also how can we think about indoor air quality as being improvements in indoor air quality as being tied to energy efficiency programs, and bringing that all together to ensure that we all have a safe, affordable place to live in the future.
Well, I think I can say that MCAN is blessed to have your vision and insight on board. I know. Let's see. What's the website if people want to learn more about MCAN? Where would they go? How would they, you know, how would they seek out MCAN?
Well, you can find us on social media. You can also go to our website, which is massclimateaction.org. You can learn all about our roughly 61 volunteer nodes across the state. I'll do a shout out for Green Newton. They are actually one of the, so Newton, for those of you who don't know, is sort of a relatively, it's a city right outside of Boston. It's where I grew up. Affordable housing has not typically been a top priority for that particular city, but Green Newton has been incredibly instrumental in raising awareness and actually developing partnerships with affordable housing developers in Newton, and really beginning to bring these two systems together, the systems that reduce emissions and that provide affordable housing options for Newton residents.
And that sinks right into the MCAN model of having a replicable kind of a learning opportunity, right, for the other cities and towns.
Yes.
That's great. Well, Sarah, I really appreciate your taking the time to come on and chat. What we'll do is in the blog that we associate here, we will put up links. And I usually say we'll put up links at the blog, which is at massclimateaction.org. But you just said that, so it's all the same place. You can go there and sign up. If you have any questions, we would love to hear from you at the email podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what's good, what's bad, what we ought to be talking about. Those are all good things. You are, of course, listening to this podcast on your smartphone using a modern podcast distribution application, but you can tell all your friends that they can do the same thing on their favorite modern podcast distribution app, because we are on all of them. We're going to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it was a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. And yeah, and people feel free to reach out to me directly as well. I have a simple email, S-A-R-A-H, Sarah at massclimateaction.net. It may take me a few hours or a few days to reply to you, but I will. I promise.
That's great. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.